We're really privileged to have the guests that we do with us today. There's a youth conference that gathers tonight and through the next couple of days. And we were able to make this connection because Irwin is with us tonight in that conference and able to come a little early and be with us here in this lunch meeting. And it's really quite significant as well because Irwin found out not long ago, just weeks ago, of being diagnosed with cancer and had surgery 4 weeks ago, major surgery. And he's a very unique individual. He told me his story a little bit earlier today. I still can't wrap my mind around it that well, of just the fortitude that he has to step out after having this process and having the surgery and to keep moving. He's just not going to sit down, and the doctors probably wouldn't advise him to be here, but he's here because that's what's in his heart and in his soul, and he's already been traveling and using his gifts to bestow life to people everywhere that he can. So a very remarkable person. Irwin McManus is a thought leader, really. There's a message I heard him preach just, man, it's probably been 7-8 years ago that still resonates with me and even in our church, where he talked about moving from first space where we are comfortable with each other into second space and ultimately into third space, where when we get invited into a space that we're not comfortable in, where there's unbelievers and people that don't think the way we do, we know that we're about to see some miraculous things happen. And we've been motivated by that message to not just surround ourselves with people like ourselves, but be open to where God wants to plant us so that we can change the world. And Irwin is that kind of leader. He's a world changer. He has found a way to integrate creativity and spirituality in a way like no other. His books are renowned. I hope you have them in your library and have a chance to make use of them. Would you give a good welcome today for Mosaic Church in Los Angeles, the founder of that church, author, a leader, a man of incredible inspiration, Irwin McManus. Give him a good welcome here today.
Have a seat.
I can't lift anything quite that heavy yet. Behind me, because what's behind me doesn't matter. Wow, thank you so much, Rick, for inviting me to be here. And this is amazing. I mean, this many pastors and leaders in a common space moving together. It's very rare and really beautiful. I just really encourage you and commend you for that. And you know, as I was listening to the testimonies in the video and just hearing some of the passion and intention around this, I started thinking about what the dynamic or tension of unity really is, because I think sometimes the great challenge is that we're motivated by unity, but we end up moving toward conformity. And that becomes one of the great tensions. I love sports, and Rick is right. Right before Christmas, our doctor told us that I had cancer, and I knew something was wrong with me for the last 10 years, but I was kind of busy, and so I didn't take time to really figure out what was going on, and it was fairly developed, and I didn't know how extensive it would be, and my family was having to go through Christmas trying to figure out whether the cancer was in my bones or had traveled widespread, and all I was planning to do is get some knee treatment so I could keep playing basketball, and in the process found out that I had cancer, and they moved fast, and so 4 weeks ago, they operated on me, and it was amazing. I had the surgeon who created the robot, who does the surgery, named Da Vinci, and so I love that as an artist. I just thought it was great, and I'm a work of art, and Da Vinci has had his work and his hands in me. So I have 6 holes in my stomach right now. Today's the first day I've wore pants, so I'm like really excited, and not that I've been going around without pants, but I've been wearing sweatpants now for the last 4 weeks, so I brought pants with me. So I text my son, I said, "I'm wearing pants!" Exclamation point. He goes, "Awesome." every victory. We're just celebrating every moment and all the way through here. And in this process, they told me, you know, you had to go through this long kind of waiting period. And they operated on me, put me in my room at 9:30 at night. At 1 in the morning, I got myself up and took off and started walking down the hall. And they thought I was out of my mind. And they said, do you need painkillers? I said, no, I want to know what I'm facing, because most people don't recover because they're afraid to face the pain and push themselves beyond the point of pain. And so then I walked again at 6. I got myself showered, dressed at 8, and told them I was ready to go. It was less than 12 hours after they finished the surgery. And then I had to go through that horrible process of, you know, code word catheter, and which is supposed to still be in like now, which I would not be here. And so I called them up and said, get this thing out of me. So that was out in a week. And I said, how long before I can like be active? And said, you know, it's going to be a little while. It's going to take you some time. And so 3 weeks into the process, I grabbed my wife, Kim, and I said, honey, I love you. And I moved her down the hallway and I dropped my athletic bag down the stairs. I called some guys up. I rented a basketball gym. And so 3 weeks after surgery, I'm in a basketball court playing basketball. There's a little bleeding, but but my threes were on target, and so it was a good day. And so I played basketball 3 times now in the first month, and ready to roll, watching God just do beautiful things. But I started thinking, I love sports. This is why I really bring this up. And you can have an illusion of unity. And because if you play football, every team looks unified in the huddle, but there's nothing advancing in the huddle. And my great concern oftentimes in the church is that we consider the huddle unity. And unity is actually when everyone's moving at their proper rate of speed and power and force and talents and ability. Unity is when Tom Brady throws a pass and somebody makes an unbelievable catch and wins the Super Bowl, because what they're doing when they're apart creates synergy, not what they're having conversation about when they're together. And I think the great problem in the church is that when we huddle, we try to make everyone a quarterback, or we try to make everyone a left tackle, or we try to make everyone a wide receiver. And that's why we have such a difficult time with unity in the church, because we're not comfortable with that wide receiver running a 4-2 down the field, that offensive right tackle blowing back 300 pounds of aggression, that quarterback just taking 5 steps back, and everyone doing something completely different that doesn't look the same. But you know it's unity when the space between you creates greater power than even when you're together. So there's my thoughts on unity and conformity and the church. And I think that's why people always ask us, you know, does Mosaic, do you do things with other churches? And a great challenge sometimes is when you're the wide receiver and you're not the center, and everyone wants you to be the center. And I found this to be true because, frankly, I think we have a hard time with God's unfairness in relationship to talent. I'm in meetings all the time with pastors who criticize really successful, effective pastors. And I go, why don't we just own the fact that we're all bitter that they're more talented than us? And, you know, so all you can do is run the ball because you can't pass. And so you're going to say passing is wrong. It's evil. And there's arrogance involved. God's not in it. And so I want to celebrate every church and every pastor who's more gifted than me, who is able to do things I could never do on my own. And I just say, that's incredible. I love that. You know, and years ago, I had to accept the fact that for some reason, the majority of people do not enjoy my communication style or me as a person. And when I began being a pastor, I wanted everyone to like me. How about you? I wanted everyone to love me, and I wanted to somehow be able to communicate to everyone. And I began to realize that when I tried to be everything for everyone, it became nothing for no one, because I didn't even know who I was. And one of the great challenges is realizing that if God wanted everyone to be the same, he would have just called the same person to everything. But he desperately needs people to be different. Years ago, when one of our elders, who's Japanese, and he's an incredibly gracious and beautiful human being, he came to me and he said, I spent the last year studying why most people cannot understand you. Thank you so much. That's what everyone wants an elder doing. You know, rather than saying, I spent the last year studying why a rare, unique demographic of people are deeply moved by your communication style, he felt it was really important to figure out why most people don't get me. And he is a brilliant researcher, probably 100,000 books in his library and read them all. And he began to explain to me about linear thinkers and systemic thinkers and sequential thinkers. And he was explaining to me essentially why only 1% of people would ever really get what I have to say. And so I absorbed that deeply, and I realized that in a very beautiful way, mega churches speak in a narrative and at a wavelength that the majority of people can understand. But the problem, of course, is if you base everything God is doing from the center rather from the edges. And maybe that's what I want to talk to you just for a couple of minutes. That the great danger in the church is that people who are not in Jesus, who are not in the kingdom, who do not yet know him, do not feel that there's a place for them in the kingdom, because there's such a high value for conformity and standardization in the church that people who are uniquely crafted to march on the edges of life think the gospel is irrelevant to them. And so one of the things I've resolved in my own life is that there are some people who are gifted to be Billy Graham. And their message, it speaks to 50,000 people at a time. But there's this unique group of 5 people who have a disproportionate amount of impact on the world, who think differently and see everything from a different vantage point. And they'll never be brought to Jesus in that story. And so sometimes you wonderfully gifted people, you are the nuclear bombs of the earth. When you step into a room, everyone is shaken. But every once in a while, God needs to call out assassins, you know, sharpshooters, who are able to enter into the psychological, intellectual, cultural spaces that no one else knows how to get to. And I feel like, because someone came up to me outside, and I'm 58, and 30 days away from having cancer surgery, and yeah, I'm happy I'm wearing pants, and so my wardrobe selection is minimal. But somebody came up to me and said, "I'm so glad that, you know, you're over 40 and refuse to dress like you're over 40." And I know that was a compliment. Thank you so much. And I just said, "Well, to do anything else would require me to go out and buy different clothes." But you see, here's the dilemma, is that I didn't dress like this after 40. I was like this before 40. I just happened to become a Christian. And I happened to be called in the ministry, and no one really knew what to do with me because I wouldn't conform to what I was told I had to be. See, the truth is, you didn't dress like you were over 40 when you got over 40. You dressed like that when you were 20. Because you were over 40 when you were 20. I'm just speaking truth. That's all I'm doing, all right? But here's my point in all this, is that we have a picture of what an adult looks like. We have a picture of what a Christian looks like. We have a picture of what a human looks like. We have a picture of what Jesus looks like in a human. And if we don't learn how to move from unity being everyone on the same page to everyone writing their own page in the same story, we're not going to reach this world in the way that Jesus wants us to. And I've come to this realization that God made us different, not just so that we could be unique, but that we become this interconnected stream. There's someone that I will never reach, but beautifully enough, there's someone I can reach who's just enough like me where they get the message of Jesus from me, but they're just different enough where they can actually pass it on to a person who would never listen to me. And so there's an interconnectedness between us. I know this may be hard to believe, but I didn't grow up in church. Maybe that's easy to believe. But when I first pastored, I was actually I was a pastor of a black church, and I was a black preacher, and T.D. Jakes has nothing on me, I'm telling you. And I used to say, I don't know how you can preach without sweating. I didn't get it, you know. And our congregation was completely African American. It was in one of the most intensely violent communities in the United States. And that's who raised me. And everywhere that I went, I began realizing that how you communicate is in so many ways as important as what you're communicating. And too many of us are more concerned with how we want to say things rather than how people need to hear it. So I just want to leave you with a thought. Maybe we can have a few minutes of Q&A. When I became a believer, they told me to go to seminary. I didn't know what a seminary was, but I went. So instead of going to Yale and going to law school, I went to seminary and got a theology degree. And they taught me to study the Bible, to study about God. But you say amen, I know, because the Bible teaches us about God. But like I'm sitting here going, how do I know this is true about God? Because if it's in War and Peace, how do I know that's true or not? And so my mind went into an anthropological direction. I thought, I can't prove or disprove what it says about God is true, but I can prove if what it says about people is true. Because you can actually do empirical research on whether the Bible is accurate about us. So I spent my life studying the Bible as an anthropologist and a sociologist. And what happened to me is I began to be so convinced that everything it said about God was true because what it said about us was profoundly true. It unwrapped me and people and gave me a roadmap into the human spirit that I could not find any other way. But one of the things I began to discover is that really our faith has a very anemic understanding of what it means to be human. We base that you're a sinner and that covers everything. If you're more precise, total depravity, you're just a really, really bad sinner. But we never really unwrap what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God. We never unwrap this powerful truth in the scriptures that every human being is created in the image of God. And that means even if you don't believe in God, the fingerprint of God is on you. And we've never really grappled with what it looks like that 7 billion people have the image of God in them, whether they're atheists, agnostics, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Christians. And how do we redeem that? And what does it mean in terms of our engagement with human beings? And one of the things I love about being human is that there's a uniqueness of being human that's different than every other species. And I'd love to take a lot of time to wrap into that, but I want you to just listen to one passage, maybe two. I don't know, maybe three. You never know how the passage will unwrap. But in Genesis chapter 4, verses 20 to 22, I want you to hear this genealogy. Don't you love the genealogies? It says, Adah gave birth to Jabal, who became the first person to live in tents and raise cattle. Isn't that exciting? I bet you have that on your refrigerator maggot. It said, Jabal's brother was Jubal, the first person to play the harp and flute. Wow, that's goosebumpy. Zillah, it gets better. Zillah. Anybody named Zillah? No, not a popular name. Zillah gave birth to Tubal-Cain, who made tools out of bronze and iron. Now, I think a lot of times we skip the genealogies because, you know, they're only in the Bible, so they can't really have any real meaning or value. But here we have this little genealogy. It's telling us something about the human story. It says, before Jabal existed, there were no tents or herds. Before he existed, no one ever imagined a tent. And I think to myself, what would inspire a tent? I think they were marching, walking to the prairie, hunting. I don't think Jabal was a good hunter. And because usually innovation happens when you're not good at something. And so I think he was a lousy hunter. Uh-oh, my time is up. It's been great being here with you. And I actually do think my time is up. And so I see Jabal like walking with all the hunters, but he's way behind and he never really kills like the, you know, the wild boar because he gets a little nervous. And then it starts pouring down rain. And he goes, I hate this. I just hate this. My hair is not meant for rain. And one day he's able to hide in a cave and everybody's getting wet. And he realizes, man, if I could just take a cave with me everywhere I went, it'd be awesome. Like a mobile cave. And so they're hunting and they're killing gazelles and antelopes and they're throwing the carcasses to the side because they don't use the skin. But one day he just takes those leftover skins, which are worthless, and he sews them together, pitches them, and he creates the first mobile home. Now, Jabal may have been incredibly unpopular because you're going to marry the hunter because you don't want to starve. But he decides, you know, there's a far less ambitious species called cattle. They don't seem motivated to run. I don't have to hunt them. They produce milk. So he just domesticates cattle and pitches his tent. And I'm telling you, he may have been unattractive when it was sunny, but on that rainy day, he was the best looking guy in the village. Because the moment he pitched that tent, he said, baby, do you want to come be dry with me or wet with him? And then he has a brother. And I have an older brother who's super talented. And so I know what it's like to have the Jabal in your family. And his name is Jubal. You can't like make a tent because you don't want to be a me too. So Jubal invents something else. It says that Jubal is the first person to ever play a harp or a flute. That means before Jubal, there were no instruments. Isn't that incredible? We can't even imagine a world without instruments or barbecue or shelters. But the world was different before them and it has never returned after them. So how do you invent your first harp? Because if you're a musician, you know the first strings were made out of catgut. I mean, how do you find out that catgut works? Right. I'm thinking maybe his brother Jabel had a cat. Yeah. So I'm just imagining. I don't know. Maybe that cat was like zigzagging when the herd was coming through and he zigged when he should have zagged. Cat. Gut. Now, the normal healthy person just walks by the cat without looking down. You don't really stare at cat gut. But Jubal was different. See, I love Jubal. See, I'm the cat gut stare. I understand this. What do we have here? I mean, it's one thing to look at cat gut. It's another thing like to reach in and grab cat gut and then go, bung, 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 bung. I can work with this. All right? And he takes cat gut and he makes strings out of them and he carves out a piece of wood, probably because he recognized the echoing in the cave. And what Jubal did is he translated human emotions into sound. And he changed the world forever. But he wasn't done. Maybe he was walking through a decayed forest where what was once a lush array of trees, there's a hollow branches, twigs, and limbs. And he heard the wind blowing through them. Maybe in that moment of inspiration, Jubal realized, I can capture the wind and give voice to it. And he created the first flute. Because from Jubal came jubilee and jubilation and worship. And when we stand here, we worship together, and we have a harp and a flute. We have instruments that capture human emotions and translates emotions from one soul to another. We need to realize that our world would have never existed without Jubal. See, I'm convinced that the lineage of Jubals and Jabals and Tubal-Cains who created bronze and iron tools. Now, later, bronze and iron was used to create weapons, which reminds us that human imagination can go in both the direction of darkness or light. But before him, they had to dig holes with sticks and stones, and then he took iron and bronze and he made tools where they could create fields and grow harvests and feed their families and their children. It created a future. The world was never the same after Tubal-Cain. And all of these different inventions were first born in the human imagination. They all started in this invisible space of dreams and ideas, of visions. And I just wonder, how will the future be different because we existed? What exists in our imagination that must be created into humanity's reality? What does the church dream that will make the future different or better? How is it possible that the God of the future is represented by a church who's more known for holding on to the past than creating the future? How is it that we're more defined by tradition than we are by invention? Is it possible that the Jubals and Jabals and Tubal-Cains have been pushed out of the church because they did not believe that everything that has been done has been done? And they could not connect themselves to a culture that believed that the past was more promising than the future. Let me just stop here for a moment. Perfect timing. And I see, do we have time for a couple of questions, Rick? Maybe we could have a few moments of questions or interaction if you want. And if not, I'll let you guys talk to each other. And
Rick Cole.
Thank you. I have been inspired by what you shared with just your journey out of the illness that you've had and to march forward with the kind of intensity that you have. I wonder if you would mind just talking to that a little bit more. It seems like you find healing in kind of pressing through what other people would tell you not to do.
Thank you for asking a question about the substance of my message. But you're asking about the substance of my essence, which I appreciate even more, actually. years ago. Do you remember when Mike Tyson fought Buster Douglas? By the way, you are so magnetic. There's just an incredible essence that comes from your soul, from you two. You're married? You got you. Yeah, there's something really extraordinary from you guys. Side note. Okay. You remember when Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas fought? And Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson unexpectedly? Then they had a rematch. And Buster Douglas got destroyed, and he was 50 pounds overweight. He was in McDonald's that afternoon. And on sports radio, they asked, why did this happen? Why did Buster Douglas not even prepare for the second fight? Why did he not even try to defend his belt? And the other guy said, everything we know of Buster Douglas is he's a really good human being. They said he's even a deeply religious person. He's a Christian. Then the man said this, but some people are simply structured for failure. And when I heard that, I asked myself, what are my internal structures that have either structured me for failure or for success? And I'm from El Salvador. I'm an immigrant. Got in on time, in time. I never knew my father. I have one memory of my father when he kidnapped me when I was a kid. My dad spoke 12 to 14 languages, but was also a violent alcoholic. My mom left El Salvador, left me with my grandparents from the first day I was born. So my grandparents were my parents at the age of 5. And at the age of 5, my mom came back and brought me back to the States and married a man who was involved in what we called creative underground economies. And so we moved every couple of years. And I grew up in a really dysfunctional and destructive environment. In fact, Rick, one of the things they told me when they did my surgery, which took hours longer than it was supposed to, he said, we had to spend an hour and a half before we operated on you to clean out all the scar tissue from when your appendix ruptured when you were young. And I remember when I was so sick, but everyone told me I wasn't sick. To this day, I never knew that my appendix ruptured. And they had to clean it out. And I realized that, most people become weaker because everyone paves the way for them. And so they think that they've walked through a jungle, but they've just walked a path already paved for them. And you can either resent the pain and hardship you've been through in the past or realize that that's where you developed all your internal muscles. And in the same way that you have, biceps and triceps, you have muscles that develop resilience. I do not think it's an accident. I'm just going to be really un-PC here. The Latin American world has had a different cultural experience than the African American world in the United States. The African American community has emerged to be the leading innovators and thought creators of almost every genre in American culture. We have had an African American president. Oprah was the most powerful voice on television as an African American woman. Tiger Woods was the greatest African American golfer. Michael Jordan is the iconic personality of African, of basketball as an African American. If you look at every arena, I don't care, film, Denzel Washington, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Kanye are the three most iconic voices in music, all African American. Now, why is it that the Latin American world that has been here as long or longer hasn't emerged to the level of prominence in American society that the African American community? I actually think it's because the African American community was so oppressed and had to develop so much internal resilience as a culture that it did not wait for the culture to promote it. It created its own ladder up. I think the Latin world kept waiting for the Caucasian world to invite them up the ladder. And I'm Latino, so I'm just telling you what I see culturally. I actually think that when you fight against the struggles that are in front of you, you develop a resilience that gives you a strength that is unexpected. So I had surgery. They put me in my room at 9:30. I walked at 1 o'clock in the morning. I got myself up, and I went walking down the halls, and they told me I was out of my mind. They asked me if I wanted painkillers. I said no, because I want to know how much it hurts. Because if I can deal with this, I can take anything. So then I walked again at 6. I took a shower at 8, got myself dressed, and said I'm ready to leave the hospital. I decided when I was ready to go. And I found this throughout my life, that if you allow pain to establish the boundaries of your freedom, you'll always be a slave to your limitations. And, you know, and I can tell you, this is a part of the dilemma. I mean, I'm an immigrant. Spanish was my first language. And only last year was I invited for the first time to speak at a national Hispanic organization. And I told my brothers, I said, you know why you've never invited me? It's because you don't see me as Hispanic. You don't see me as Latino. Because if you don't fall into a particular standard of culture, you are no longer one of us. And I had a choice. I can tell, every time I got a job in the Christian world, after they found out I was from El Salvador, they tried to change my job from being director over everything to director over Hispanics. And I would just tell them, look, I will never take a job that's director over Hispanics. I either am qualified to lead all the humans or none of them. And but anyway, side note, that's probably not the answer you wanted. But that's my internal framework. I refuse to be structured for failure. I refuse to let what happens to me to become who I am. I will not allow environments or circumstances to define me. And to the day they told me I had cancer, I rented a basketball gym, and the next day we went and played basketball. And I told my family, I said, look, I have uncooperative cells inside of my body. And that I will have removed because they're no longer allowed to have residence inside of me. But this is not who I am. And I told our congregation, cancer may decide how I die. It does not have the power to decide how I live. You have that power. But anyway, no. Oh, thank you, bro. Okay. Does anyone have any other question? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think my voice is loud enough. I don't think I need a microphone. So I've read several of your books. Love them. I love you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you're welcome. And that's, for me, that's the extreme compliment I can give you. Could you address that as you talked about your message today, transformation and people not allowing boundaries in their past dictate their future? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, I'll try to be briefer. And the great dilemma in Christian publishing, I don't know if those of you who know I write, I stopped writing for 6 years. I gave up on writing books to Christians. It was so discouraging to me. I literally had my publishers and agents fly out to my house and tell me, if you want to sell a lot of books, you need to create low-hanging fruit. And I said, what do you mean by that? They said, Christians buy books that reinforce what they already believe. And your books challenge realities, and no one's going to read you. And it was really disturbing. I can tell you, the more awards a book wins that I've written, the fewer people read them. And my books don't sell in red states where Christians are. My books only sell in blue states where Christians aren't. And I'm actually trying to change the way we believe as believers, but I just keep missing the mark. So it was very frustrating for me. And I would get offers like, the Da Vinci Code came out. Write the book on the Da Vinci Code. You're going to sell millions. And I said, no, because I want to write books that are timeless, not timely. And I know someone needs to write timely books, but that's not my calling. Somebody needs to write books that will sell today because they know the market. And believe me, I get calls all the time. Write this book. It'll sell like crazy. I know what I could write right now that will sell like 10 million copies. But the problem is that book has like 5 minutes of value. And I don't want to be embarrassed by what I've written. And Y2K, Christians became millionaires during Y2K because they believed the world was coming to an end. So on Y2K, I put my wife and my kids and myself on a plane and flew from L.A. to Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, then from Philadelphia to Houston, then Houston to L.A. on the transitional period on the January 1, 2000. And I told our congregation, I am so disturbed by the incredible panic and paranoia in the Christian faith that we are cowards who live in fear, that my family and I were going to be on planes over Y2K when they say all technology is going to crash. If we die, you can talk about how stupid we were. But if we live, we're going to have a conversation about how stupid our faith is. And because we can't move to this level of low thinking and expect the world to come to Jesus. So some of it is that we want self-medicated writing. that says, here's how to solve your problem today. But the reality is that if your life is a mess because you've been making bad decisions for 20 years, no book is going to change your life in 20 minutes. You have to embrace a process that allows you to move toward change. You have to restructure your internal mechanism and become a different kind of human being. So that's what I write for. And that's and frankly, what's amazing to me is when I wrote my next book, which is coming out in September, the night I found I had cancer, I opened up my manuscript to edit, and the first line I read was literally this. Before you hear it from someone else, I'm dying. I wrote that before I knew I had cancer. And then the next line says, but so are you. Because we're all dying. Don't let a doctor tell you something you should already know. I didn't even know I had cancer when I wrote this. I said, our problem is that we keep lying to ourselves as if we're not dying, so we never live with the urgency and intention that we need. I think transformation comes when we realize that there's an urgency to our lives, and that while other people may be to blame for the wounds that you carry, no one is responsible for the transformation you take on. And, you know, I could spend my whole life blaming everyone for my hurt. I was in a psychiatric chair by the time I was 12 years old. I was in a hospital when I was 12 years old, in and out. And I could just spend my whole life saying, I'm like this because they did this. And I go, no, I'm like this because no matter what anyone else chose, I made different choices that were more powerful than their choices. And that's what Jesus does in our lives. And we have to help people move out of looking for magic. And a lot of our theology is based on magic. You know, Jesus is going to do this. You know, Jesus seems to work in real life and in real time. And if you keep making bad choices, you're not going to have a good future. I think it just works like that. And okay, any last question? Sure. All here. Yeah.
So Jubal is sitting in the pew each week. What's he thinking? And what's the pastor's role?
Well, Jubal probably isn't sitting in the pew. There are some Jubals in the pew, and they are future worship leaders. Tonight, our band is coming from LA, MSC. My daughter, Mariah, who just turned 25 last week, is the worship leader. And what's really awesome, she was Jubal. And but when she was 14, she wrote a song that was chosen to be the season finale for Grey's Anatomy. And so for 4 minutes and 11 seconds, because I'm a proud dad, and they played her song. And she always saw herself that way. But she didn't see herself necessarily doing it in church. She wanted to be really excellent in the real world so that she could take that excellence into the Christian world. I think a part of our problem is that we have such a low standard in the church that people who actually have a high standard for themselves take their talents elsewhere. We need to elevate the bar so high that when a person goes into the secular world, it's a step down. They go, wow, this is easy. My time is up. God bless.